I want to finish a couple of things for this third of the semester and try and tie a couple of things together. And I brought some stuff in that you'll see, not our normal things. But I want to read to you, very importantly, I think, a speech that was given by John Quincy Adams in 1839. So John Quincy Adams, unfortunately not very well remembered in American history beyond the fact that he was a pretty terrible president. He was actually a fantastic as a person, he was a genius. He was very much like Jefferson in terms of his mind and science and what he was trying to do. He had one of the best greenhouses actually in the world at the time, collected plants from everywhere. He was very interested in astronomy. He was interested in the study of all kinds of things. He was fluent in a variety of different languages and had translated Edmund Burke into German and a few other languages as well. So just a really interesting guy. But I'm going to read to you. This is from a speech he gave on April 29th of 1839. It's one of my favorite speeches in American history. It's huge. If you just go online and type John Quincy Adams' New York speech, 1839, it's something like 74 pages long. But remember, this was a time when orations could go on for a good 5 to 6 hours, and this was entertainment. So, and he was a great orator, and people could keep that attention span, which is astounding, that he could have that. But what he's trying to do here, I think very importantly, is mythologize the man that he respected just below his father, and that was George Washington. And the reason that he's doing this is because it's the 50th anniversary of George Washington's taking of the inaugural oath for the presidency. And we haven't talked too much about this, but Washington is one of those guys, and you'll see this when I read Quincy Adams, but he's one of those guys that no matter how much we exaggerated, we would still never really capture what he was like. He was so much better than what our ability to exaggerate is. And even stories that were told, these little evangelical stories that circulated in the 19th century by people like Parson Weems that talked about how George Washington would not tell a lie, and he told his father, and yes, he admitted he had cut down the cherry tree. That stuff is just rinky-dink when you really look at what the guy was really like. In fact, doing those kinds of stories denigrates his greatness because he truly was great. And he did have his faults, like all men. He very much had his faults. And I think probably his greatest fault, and one that he had to overcome, and it was very difficult for him to do so, was his womanizing. He never actually acted upon it in any kind of physical sense, but he had all kinds of relationships with women that were inappropriate. And he would write them, and they would be letters that were quasi-love letters, even when he was married or they were married. And he did get over this as a young man. He had to work on this. But you also, and not that this excuses him at all, but he was probably next to Alexander Hamilton, the best-looking man in North America. And he was one of the, it wasn't just that he was good-looking, he was. In fact, there's a moment where poor John Adams was not good-looking. He was short and very round and never, just not attractive. And Abigail, his wife, was, she's great. But there was a moment where Abigail saw George for the first time, and she wrote a letter to John. They have these incredible love letters back and forth, and just stunning. But she wrote a letter to John, and she said, "Well, you told me he was good looking, but you didn't tell me the half of it. He's the most handsome man I've ever seen." Oh, poor John. But that was very typical. And George Washington was 6'2". He had a very Roman face. He looked like what you would imagine Cato to look like, just utterly, he's not Italian at all, but he has that just kind of perfect chiseled Italian Roman look. And just always walked ramrod straight, and he was very buff. And was also just extremely charismatic and could really do, basically he could persuade if he wanted to, anyone to do almost anything. It was just his character. And people would talk about him in his day and age as though he were a demigod reborn. And that was not, even when he died, more people in the Western world knew of George Washington than they knew of King George III. So that was very telling, that here's this young Republican, this guy who had given everything, and he really was regarded as a mythical figure, even in his own day and age. He was just almost beyond human. And yet again, I can't stress enough, he had his failings. And he knew what they were. That's one of the most interesting things about him. We all have failings. Washington knew exactly what they were. And he worked very hard his whole life to turn those failings into good things. Didn't always succeed, but he did certainly try. And there were a number of them. It wasn't just that. He was very haughty at times. He knew how attractive he was. He knew how much persuasion he could have. And he tried to use that for the best of the Republic rather than just for himself. But it was hard. And he was just one of these guys who just sticks out in every way. And it would be hard for him not to have kind of been that celebrity. But it's interesting. He's not a celebrity like our modern celebrities, where they just do weird stuff and we're fascinated. He actually did normal stuff and we were fascinated. Because he was, despite all this greatness, he was really normal overall as well. And he always, I kind of laugh about this, but in his life, if you really wanted to look at George Washington, we could look at all of his successes. We could also say, this is a guy who wanted nothing more than to retire and to go home and farm and be with his wife. And yet he never could. It was the moment he did that, some crisis came up. So whether we look at him at age 21, fighting in the French and Indian War, or we look at him at 42, showing up at the Constitutional, or at the First Continental Congress, or we see him taking up arms against the British, or we see him at the Constitutional Convention, or taking up the presidency, none of those things were things he wanted. But he had that old world sense that when you were asked to do something, you do it. Not because you want to do it, but because you've been asked. And this is what men do. Men live up to their duties. And yet whenever he did these things, no matter how reluctant he was, he always threw himself entirely into what he was doing. So he was excellent at the military. And if you look at what he did in terms of his strategy when he led the Continental Army, you could, from one perspective, say he was a total failure, because he never really won any large engagements. The few times he did win were all guerrilla actions that he was able to do sneak attacks on the British. But he was most famous for running away, and he did that all the time. His troops were in battle, they were being surrounded, and he got his troops out of there. So we could mock that. We could also say he was a genius, because no matter what, his army would always be at best about the tenth the size of the British. And the worst thing that could happen to him would be to be put into a position where there's no escape. And so he constantly, as a continental force, he has to get his men out of there, and he becomes a master of strategic retreat. And again, we could mock that, but at the same time, he was able to keep that army together for 8 years, and to do so against all odds, not having money, except the money he basically gave to the military, as well as what Charles Carroll gave to the military. Congress was constantly fighting against him and trying to stall him. And there he was, always doing this and getting this thing done. And the 8 years that he leads the American Continental Army is absolutely critical as well, because that is why we have a presidency for 2 4-year terms. It comes from the fact that if you could be commander-in-chief for 8 years, you certainly don't deserve to be a civilian chief for any longer than that. That's all anyone is capable of doing, 8 years. Any more than that, and you're just arrogant. There's nothing that you can even say about yourself that's not just extremely arrogant. Now, that doesn't become law, constitutional law, until after Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, because the tradition had always been followed. Nobody would have run for a third term. That's just unacceptable, because no one's better than Washington, and you would be presenting your... Franklin Roosevelt's the first to do that. And so once the tradition's broken, it has to be made law that won't happen again. But it is a very important moment, and Washington, I think he understands best, power is dangerous, and it's not something you want to hold on to, even if you're willing to do it, even if you are good at it. In fact, that may be the very reason not to do it, because you are good at it, so you step down. Yes?
I could be wrong about this, but
oh, please.
Theodore Roosevelt tried to run for a third term like a little later.
He did, but remember, his first term was not a full term, because he came in as vice president. So that was actually acceptable. So he had only had a partial term, and therefore he was truly eligible for a second full term. So now had he, I think, I can't remember exactly, but if McKinley had died something like a week earlier, he would not have been able to have done that, because it would have, I mean, it's something, it's not quite that, but it's really close. So Roosevelt, and he, Roosevelt's pretty hot, pretty cocky too. And I could see that he would have thought if anyone could have three terms, he could. But he didn't actually violate that, and wouldn't have had he been elected another time. So that's a great question, really great question. Okay, good, so just keep that in mind, that and of course it's his cousin, right, who does those Roosevelt's. Anyway, so this is what, just, I'm not gonna read obviously the whole 74-page speech. I'm just gonna give you the first paragraph, but it's gorgeous. And you don't need to write any of this down. In fact, I'd rather you just listen to it. And if you want, I'll send it to you, what I have, or you can look it up. So Quincy Adams is asked to give the speech. And the speech is to commemorate Washington, the 50th anniversary of Washington taking the oath of office in New York City, because that was the capital. And John Quincy Adams, if you know much about him, he had been Secretary of State, possibly, arguably, our greatest Secretary of State ever in history. He was just astounding at it. And then after that, he was president. Total failure. And he knew he was a total failure. And when he wasn't reelected, he became suicidal. So he was so depressed after about 4 years that he had lost the presidency that he was constantly, he just suffered from severe depression and was not thinking about much except suicide. Until finally a good friend of his said, there's no shame in you taking another office. Why don't you run for the House of Representatives? And he does, and he wins from his district. And can you imagine a president, highest office, going to the lowest elected office? But he was incredible. It was him. He was a natural representative, just in every way. He just thrived in the House. And he became the leading anti-slavery man. He was hilarious. People loved him because he was so funny. He was obnoxious, but he was funny. And it was during the time that they had what was called the gag rule, so that you could not mention the word slavery on the House floor without being kicked. You'd be in contempt of Congress and you'd be kicked out. And Adams would say, he'd raise his hand, I'd like to speak on the tariff bill. Yes, chair recognizes John Quincy Adams from Braintree, Massachusetts, and he would come down there and he would literally say, ha, I fooled you, I'm gonna talk about slavery. And then he would just go on and think, you're out of order. And he just kept going. And there were times he got kicked out of the House, but he didn't care. He just constantly did that. Until finally, this amazing moment, through his own persistence, the House finally, because they respected him so much, they repealed the gag order. And slavery could be discussed again, all because of him. And he even died on the House floor. He gave a speech, walked back to his chair, and he died. Just, it was incredible, really, to think about his career. So he found a second life, and a brilliant life. And he didn't go off and make a huge tower to his presidency like our modern presidents do. Yeah, he served. And I think that speaks volumes about his character. So here's what Quincy Adams says about his second favorite hero after his dad, George Washington. Would it be an unlicensed trespass of the imagination to conceive that on the night preceding the day of which you now commemorate the 50th anniversary, on the night preceding that 30th of April, 1789, when from the balcony of your city hall, the Chancellor of the State of New York administered to George Washington the solemn oath faithfully to execute the office of the President of the United States, and to the best of his ability to preserve, to protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. All right, all fine so far. Now it's going to get really mythic. That in the visions of the night, the guardian angel of the father of our country appeared before him in the venerated form of his mother, and to cheer and encourage him in the performance of the momentous and solemn duties that he was about to assume, delivered to him a suit of celestial armor, a helmet consisting of the principles of piety, of honor, of justice, of benevolence, with which this man had walked since his earliest infancy through his entire life, in the presence of all of his brethren. She also gave him a spear studded with the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence, a sword, the same with which he had led the armies of his country through the War of Freedom to the summit of the triumphal arc of independence, a corselet of long experience and habitual intercourse in peace and war with the world of mankind, his contemporaries of the human race in all their stages of civilization, And last of all, the Constitution of the United States, a shield embossed by heavenly hands with the future history of its country written upon it. Now, that's amazing. And nobody in that audience is going to take this literally. It's all meant to be symbolic and mythic. Who is this George Washington? And to my mind, this makes Parson Weems seem like a piker. You know, we can make up all the stories we want about the cherry tree. This is the real Washington, even in its mythological essence, right? Even in its garb here of falseness, there's something so true about it. Just think about the sources. First of all, anybody catch, and this is the most obscure reference, but it also tells us a lot about the Americans of this day and age and what they would have expected in a speech. What would the self-evident truths that were written on the spear refer to? Anyone know? You'd have to be into some really serious minutia of mythology to know this, but it is really cool. So, Santiago, any guess? Anybody? Odin. The reason Odin was so brilliant, and it was part of the agreement he made with the fates, is that he was given a spear from the tree of creation, Yggdrasil, which would be the equivalent of the tree of life in the Bible, except it's Norse and pagan, so it's not quite equivalent. And from the tree of life, the first tree, he carved into it the natural law. And so wherever Odin went, he could always refer to it because he carried that. So the declaration is the spear of the gods. It has the natural law written upon it. And if you have that, you have God's law with you, that you carry with you. Now, I'm not asking you to agree with all this. I just want you to understand the kind of mythic element. All right, what else? Anybody catch? I mean, suit of celestial armor? We've got to have some people in here to know their New Testament. Hey, what's this from? Yeah.
Ephesians?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Ephesians 6, right? This is, what do you do? Well, you carry your armor to extinguish the darts of the enemy. And you have the whole list of things. There's one other reference here. I've got it right up here. Anybody catch? A very classical reference as well. So imagine you've got Norse mythology, you've got Christian theology, but you also have, very importantly, a scene directly out of the Aeneid. So, okay, why is that? What would Americans think about this? So let me read to you this passage. This is from Book 8 of the Aeneid, which, by the way, outside of Lord of the Rings, is my favorite book for what it's worth. It's so good. So here we have the story. Venus, goddess of love, lustrous among the cloud banks, bore her gifts, and she approached, and when she spotted her son Aeneas alone, off in the glade's recess, by the frigid stream, she hailed him, suddenly there before him, "Look, just forged to perfection by all my husband's skills, here are the gifts I promised. There is no need now, Aeneas, for you to flinch from fighting those swaggering Latins." And with that, Venus reached to embrace her son and set the brilliant armor down before him under a nearby oak. Aeneas takes delight in the goddess's gifts and the honor of it all, and he runs his eyes across it piece by piece. He can never get enough of them, and he is filled with wonder. He turns them over now with his hands, now his arms. There's a terrible crusted helmet plumed with shooting fire, and a sword blade honed to kill, and a breastplate made of solid bronze, its blood red and immense. It's like a dark blue cloud inflamed by the sun's rays, and it would gleam in the heavens. Then there's the burnished greaves of electrum, smelted gold, and that spear and that shield. The workmanship of the shield, especially, no human words could tell. For there upon it was written the entire story of Rome in all of her triumphs. For there the fire god had forged them. For he was well aware of all the seers, and he was schooled in the times to come. He knew of all the order of the generations, all the wars they would wage, and all the good they would do. So this is almost word for word from the Aeneas. And I want you to think about this. We know Paul was classically trained. You ever wondered? I'm not saying by any means that Ephesians was not written as the word of God, but it is very interesting that Paul's story is almost word for word identical to what Venus gives here, in terms of the armor and the breastplate of God and the dart and so forth. So everything comes together here. And this is, you guys probably, depending on where you're at Hillsdale, you might be getting sick of this. But to me, John Quincy Adams, in this speech, nowhere better explains what Hillsdale stands for when he has basically said, who are we? Well, we are the inheritors of the Judeo-Christian Greco-Roman heritage. It all comes together here, and you see that in this one speech. And Washington is that key figure. And for those of you who've taken great books, you know the story of the Aeneid is a story of hope. No matter what happens, the Greeks come in, they take down Troy, they do it through terrible, illegal, immoral, unethical means because they're not willing to fight on the battlefield as men against men. They sneak in at the dark of night. They do so through a trick. And when they come in to Troy, they hit all the women and children first. And so you only have a few survivors of these men. And Aeneas decides that he can replant their culture somewhere. They go to North Africa and it fails. And ultimately he ends up on the Tiber in Rome and he's able to recreate that, but only when he mixes his people with the Latins, with the natives, and they become this new people, the Trojans and the Latins that create Rome. And that's no different than our story of the English coming over and mixing with the Indians. It's the same story. And Washington was almost always called the American Aeneid, the American Aeneas. And there's something here that I think is quite beautiful, as we've talked about before, and that is you can replant your truth anywhere as long as it's true. And so that's what we're getting at here and what the Aeneid really stresses. So Washington in his life, I think, helps explain so much of this. But let me tell you this as well. And then I want to end with one quote. Natalie, can I borrow your book? I very stupidly forgot mine. Remember I told you if you don't have yours, you shouldn't come to class? So I could have walked out, I guess, but I wanted to at least act as though I knew what I was talking about here. Okay, I'll get to this in 1 second. I want to find first inaugural address. So, having said that, there it is, good. Thank you, Natalie. So having said that, I want to tell you all, and this is something you may know, but when the Founding Fathers wrote their documents, the four organic documents, almost all of them, with the exception of George Washington and a few others, had had formal training in the liberal arts. They had been educated in the classics. And this is where I think it's very interesting. College, which was not easy to get into, there were only 9 colleges in what would become the United States during the founding period. But they all had the same curricula because they were all liberal arts colleges. So they were 4 years of studying the classics, generally. If you wanted to do accounting, that was fine. You did that as an apprentice. If you wanted to study law, totally fine. You did that as an apprentice. You don't do that in college. College is strictly for learning the classics. But in order to get into college, and you were usually about age 14 when you went to college, and of course, it was all male. Hillsdale's the first college to allow women to earn a liberal arts degree anywhere in the world. So we're the first. There's nothing like that in the founding period. You have to be a young male. But in order to get in, so you would go to college from age 14 to 18. So exactly, you start college when they would have finished. And then they might have gone on to grad school, but that's really, really rare. You'd have to go to Europe to do that. You couldn't do that in America. So if you went to college at age 14, you would be given a week of entrance exams. Now just imagine this. I hated the SAT and ACT. That stuff drives me crazy, and I still hate them. And I don't think they're good judges of people, but regardless, yeah, they're there, and there's not much we can do about it. So, but imagine going to a college, say you want to get into William & Mary. You would go, and I'm going to read to you. This is, actually, let's do Columbia, because that's the one I have, the actual written. It was not called Columbia yet. It's called King's College. And of course, once you have the revolution, you can't call it King's College anymore. So what do? You turn it into the Goddess of Liberty and make it Columbia. You couldn't give a better slap to the king than that. But here, I'm going to read to you from the entrance requirements to get into King's College, Columbia. This would be about 1755. A student, age 14, must prove complete fluency in Latin and Greek. Okay, now just... how many of you at 18 or 19 or 20 have complete fluency in Latin? Probably a few of you. But imagine, that's your entrance exam. So we know, and of course there's no public schooling yet. All schooling would have been church schooling and homeschooling at this time. You might have community schools in New England, but they're always through the church. All schooling, always. This was true up until the Civil War. if you had a year or two of schooling, maybe if you could afford it, your parents would have sent you to school, say when you're 7 and 8. All you would have done all day long, you would have only been drilled in Greek and Latin. That's it. That's all school was. Because English, you learn at home. It'd be a total waste of time for you to learn something like that in school. That's why it's a mother tongue. You learn that from your mother. Mathematics, well, you just learn that on the farm. Right? So things we think about reading, writing, arithmetic, if you don't do that stuff by the time you get to school at age 7, you're kind of done. That's it. Yeah, that's not what school is for. School is only for Greek and Latin. And it depends on the mood of your teacher. If you show up at 8 in the morning, he may feel like he needs to drill you until 6 at night. There was no actual end unless he wanted, maybe he'd only go to noon. But all he did was he would drill you in Greek and Latin. So I want you to think about this because this is incredibly important. The entire American population has an understanding of Latin and Greek in a way we don't even have. Even illiterate people had a common language of Greek and Latin. So if I were to talk to any American audience, whether it's at Walmart or Burger King or here on Hillsdale's campus, and I brought up the Aeneid, you would all know what the story is. Even if you didn't read it, you would know it. It's as much a part of the air, even if you've never read a Batman comic, you all know who Bruce Wayne is. Right? That's how much this was a part of the culture. And let me give you two examples here. I'll still read from Columbia. But two examples that I think are just brilliant. You ever wondered about American Revolutionary soldiers? They fought. They fought alongside the French. French troops in the major battles were almost always two-thirds of American forces. So Americans made up about a third of the army, always augmented by the French troops. No Americans learned French. That's a peasant language. And no French learned English. That's a peasant language. So all orders, all discussions among officers on the field, it's always in Latin. All the battle orders that are released are all in Latin. They're screaming Latin as they run into battle. Now, that's a different world in so many ways. And my other favorite example, in 1786, a publisher came out with Alexander Pope's new translation of the Iliad. And a lot of people thought it was terrible. So one Boston newspaper took it upon itself, the Massachusetts Spy, 1786. They put out several issues of the paper, with all the Greek original on one side and Pope's translation on the other, so the Americans could choose for themselves, decide if it was a good Greek translation or not. This is a different world. Can you imagine if I put a Greek essay in the Hillsdale Daily News? It would just, you know, and I couldn't do it, but I'm just saying, you know, people would just think something had gone wrong with the print. It's like, what? Okay, so to get in a full week, here's what you have to do to get into King's College or any of the other colleges. You would have to read and translate from the original Latin into English 3 of Cicero's orations. Now, those are long. That's not, here's a paragraph, right? They would take you a couple of days. And then you would have to translate the first 3 books of Virgil's Aeneid, translate it from Latin into English and then into Greek. And you would be given the first 10 chapters of the Gospel of St. John to translate from Greek into Latin into English. You would also, 2 other things which I love, you would also have to be an expert in arithmetic and have a blameless moral character. Now, that last one always cracks me up because I think, well, if you are fluent in Greek and Latin at 14, what else have you been doing? Okay, but here's my point, and this is why you can have Washington be this kind of demigod. It's what the people know. St. Paul is as close to these people as Virgil is. They have grown up from ages 6 through 14 to 17, knowing all of the classics, knowing Aristotle, knowing Plato, knowing Virgil, knowing Tacitus, knowing Livy, knowing Cicero, in the same way we all know Batman. And that was their world. That's what they grew up with. And that really is just stunning to think about. And that's a world we've lost. hey, it's just gone. And yet, it's not totally gone. You get weird little places like Hillsdale, where we actually believe it's important to learn what the founders knew. And that we want to think, okay, something, they had something to make a constitution. They knew something, we don't. But we've lost that. And we've lost it, basically. It started with Ulysses S. Grant when he started the school system. Because the public school system, and I'm not just ripping on public schools, I'm a product, at least of high school, public high school, don't hold that, it's problems. There's a lot of craziness going on. But regardless, you don't need to know all that. Maybe someday. Anyway, it's just, yeah, it was what happens. Education becomes education for democracy, not for eternity. And you can't read Virgil and not believe in eternity. It's, even if he's a pagan. Because everything has purpose. Everything matters. And nobody does not have a place. Everybody has it. So, okay, is that everybody kind of clear on that? So let me end with this. And Natalie, thank you for letting me borrow your book. I just want to point out page 201. And we'll start our class after this. But on page 201, we have George Washington's first inaugural. And this, I think, in so many ways, this full paragraph, the first full paragraph, right there at line 8, this paragraph is really just the essence of what America was and what it was meant to be. And I think Washington, we see his genius here. We know he had help from Madison and Hamilton in writing this. But it's still Washington, and it's still his words, and it's his idea. So he says, I dwell on this prospect with every satisfaction which an ardent love for my country. By the way, country should be capitalized. So that's our failure. In fact, it's my failure specifically that that's not capitalized. Since there is no truth more thoroughly established that there exists in the economy and course of nature an indissoluble union. It's not possible to break these apart, ever. Between virtue, doing what's right, and happiness, having a satisfied life. Between duty and advantage, between the genuine maxims of an honest and magnanimous policy and the solid rewards of public prosperity and felicity. We ought to be no less persuaded that the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right, which heaven itself has ordained. And since the preservation of the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the republican model of government are justly considered as deeply, perhaps as finally staked on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. Now, that is so, so perceptive in so many ways. And notice there is no arrogance in this. There's no haughtiness. This is purely the words of someone who recognizes the truth. You each have been given this incredible gift. Don't blow it. Because if you blow it, you're not just blowing it for yourself, you're blowing it for the past who sacrificed so much for you to be here, and you're blowing it for the future. And the story of the Aeneid is the perfect story. Because you never, ever know when ill will hit. You only know that it will, and you have to be prepared to preserve it. And can you imagine when Socrates spoke in 399, that he would actually imagine that nearly 3,000 years later, in a world he didn't even know existed, we'd be sitting in a classroom, in a basement room, still remembering him? That's incredible to think about that. You know, when Cicero dies, he's not thinking, oh, well, you know, thank God I've got an Alex who, you know, so many years later will remember me. That's what we need. He just knows it's the right thing. And he has hope against hope that maybe someone will remember, not him, but his action, his sacrifice. And that's all Washington is saying. He's not saying you're American, and therefore you're the greatest thing ever. He's saying you're American, and therefore you have the greatest burden any people has ever been given. Don't blow it. And if you act on this, if you always recognize that every right you have has a corresponding duty, if you always give justice, if you always recognize due where due is deserved, you'll do okay. You're not going to be perfect, but you'll do okay. And this is a guy who doesn't just preach it. He lives it every day of his life. The guy who would much rather be home with Martha and farming, but he can't. He's got got to fight, he's got to lead, he's got to be president. Doesn't want to, but he's got to do it. And thank God, I'm just not sure, it's personality really matters. I'm not sure anyone else could have done what he did. He was truly the indispensable man. Okay, that's it. Any final questions or thoughts from anybody on this? Okay, so we've got just a little less than 15 minutes. If any of you have questions about the exam, I'm more than happy to talk about it. If individually you want to take off, that's fine. If you want to stay, totally fine. We go into complete anarchy here. So ordered anarchy, but complete anarchy. So anybody have, Katie, I know you'd asked earlier.
Yeah, do you have any guidelines on how to study for the multiple choice part?
Well, the goal of the test, and you guys are getting picks because I've never done it quite like this. In my 18 years, is the first time I've done just essay for a test. And part of it's because it's the 50-minute format, and yeah, you've only got a short amount of time. But the tests are made. And so two of those questions out of the six I gave you do appear, and you'll have to choose one. So you won't have to prepare all six, yet you know that you can at least skip one and you'll be safe. So you really only have to prepare five. So two pieces of advice. My goal in this is to get you individually or in your groups to think about everything we've talked about. So you don't have to bring everything in, but I'm asking you, the questions are meant to say, okay, why did we do what we did for 5 weeks? Why did we read what we did? Why did we focus on certain things? Why do these things matter? So I want you all to come away with a good understanding of 1620 to basically 1800 or 1801. I mean, we really only got up to Washington's administration, so really kind of 1797, but close enough. And so I want you to think about, well, what does this mean? What is the American character? What develops here? And whether it's religion or natural law or natural rights, I want you to kind of think of the themes that tie everything together. So my goal is to get you to think about the whole semester as one. But the second piece of advice I would offer, so that's number one, think about it that way. And by the way, you know, this is, for those of you who are first year, and I know not many of you are, but it's always good. You know, this is not meant to be arrogant, just it's realistic. Your professors are all quirky individuals. So you do kind of need to know what they think is important. Even if you don't agree with them, it's just important that you know when you're taking a test. And especially if you have a good professor, it doesn't matter who that professor is, you should all, if you get some time, you should be able to figure out exactly what the exam's going to be. If you can't, either you haven't thought about it enough or your professor failed. But an exam should reflect, at some level, everything you've done and try to pull it together. But it is always individual, so even if Dr. Marino or Dr. Kaltoff, my colleague, came in, two I'm probably most alike in the department, we'd still teach things a little differently just because it's just the nature of humanity. But my second piece of advice is this, and that is don't stress too much about each individual question. If you'll notice, there's a lot of overlap. And on some of the questions, there's probably about 80% overlap. So you could probably write 80% of the same essay, but just put a different shift in the remaining 20%. And I would say overall, there's probably 50% overlap for all of the questions. So just make sure you keep that in mind. It's probably best to approach it, especially since I'm asking you to put a lot of different things together, it's best to approach it as pieces to a whole, rather than, and each containing part of the whole, rather than radically separate things. Does that help? Okay. So that, I mean, certainly when I made up the test, that's what I was thinking. Whether I did it correctly or not, that's what I thought.
So is there no separate free response part or multiple choice?
Nope. No, there will be in the final. Okay. But yeah, the final will be three parts. Okay. So you'll have short answers and definitions and your essay. But this is just the essay. And your second midterm will most likely be a similar, just the essay thing again. So, good. Any follow-up? Chloe?
The first question, we were talking about the people groups. That did not include the Catholics who settled in Maryland. Do you want us to note that?
I think it would be important to at least note them as another fact and factor, especially given that they did try to go for straight religious tolerance and failed. But they gave it for a bit. You know, you've got roughly a good 30, 40 years of almost pure religious freedom there. So, yeah, I would think it would be important, even though you didn't read a document from Maryland, I would think that they would have to play a role almost in all of the essays, simply because of the fact of religious freedom. Even if it's a minor mention, I think they should be there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then for republicanism, I was looking through my notes and we did like the four key attributes.
Of American republicanism. Right, obviously the French had a different view.
Right, do you want us to pull in the French or just...
I think it'd be, again, pretty important to at least talk about them, whether that's a sentence or two or a paragraph or a half of the answer, you know, as a comparison. I think it would be important.
And then would anything from Cato be relevant?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, anything you want. Yeah, so one of the ways, and when I grade, I pretty much assume, and this is not personal, it's just when I go into it, I always start with an A. So you have an A, and as I grade, I take points off, depending, and it's on a lot of different things. I never grade you on your views, ever. I just grade on how you get to those views. So we could radically disagree on something, and I'm totally fine with that, as long as you made the case for why you believe what you believe. And I may disagree with you, but that's not a grade off. And I don't, when I grade these, you'll see I don't put a ton of marks. In fact, usually I only put stuff when I'm really excited about something you write. And it's understated. I quickly write good, and that means like most amazing thing I've ever read. Just because I'm, you know, going through, and I've got almost 50 of you guys this semester. So it's, well, anyway, that's my choice. But so I go through, and what I do then, I'll read them twice. So I'll read it once just to get a feel for what you're doing. And then I'll read it a second time to see the kind of evidence you use. And in that, I like to see for an A answer, I think it's essential for an A answer, you really do have to show that you've read the documents fairly carefully. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. I've taught the documents for 18 years now, so for better or worse, I've got them fairly well memorized. So you can bring something up that I know we didn't talk about in class. You can either just mention it, or you can actually do paraphrasing. I've had students before with photographic memories who've given me entire quotes. I'm not expecting, it's impressive, but I'm not expecting that. So you don't have to do that. But I do want to see that you've incorporated everything, everything from the lecture too. And I think I only missed one lecture taping. So you guys know you can, all of them are on the website if you need. And it's always been your class I've recorded, not the other section. So you can always go back and listen to any of those as well. So you have all the lectures there. But yeah, I want to see kind of a combination of the lectures and the documents. But I want to see a lot of you in it too, obviously. Yeah, I want to see particularly how Katie deals with this. Right, good. Okay, anything else? Anything specific? Yeah.
Just in terms of like formatting, do you want to see like intro, body, conclusion, or is it more of just say like answer the question in the logical and reasonable?
Yeah, it's it's kind of a both. It's not an either or, but a both and. I'd like to see some formality, but I certainly will not grade you on grammar, style, or spelling. Right? And that's just not, I'm not going to do that. It is argument that I'm really looking for, evidence and argument. But I do think there are good ways to present an argument. So I don't want bullet points. This has to be essay. Right? If you run out of time or something, obviously a bullet point is better than nothing. But this needs to be an essay. So in that sense, I want you to at least thought out kind of a thesis statement and a body and a conclusion for each of these. It doesn't have to be perfect, but just to show the argument. Yeah. Yes?
So do you want us to know specific dates for things?
The more you know, the better.
Okay.
But that's not what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Not specifically, but you know, just there are certain times where a date's critical.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we're dealing with such a small time period. So if you ended up saying, oh, the Puritans came in 1628, I would probably mark it and say 1629, but I probably would not take much time for that. Now, if you said they came in 1780, that would be wrong. So as long as it's, you know, pretty close. Good. Names and dates are only good if they get you to someone else. In and of themselves, they're just trivia. All right, well, good. So remember, I'll have the blue books, and you'll have a proctor, and just come in. I should email Dr. Westblade and let him know that you guys will be coming in, so maybe you can kind of finish up. But you'll have a full 15 minutes, and you guys have been great, so I have no worries about how you're going to do. So I will see those guys. I get back late Sunday night, so I will look forward to greeting them. So thanks, everyone. Just a DC.
Just a DC.
Yeah, well, 8 hours and 3 minutes from here. So.